Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest revelations of scandal consuming the Republican presidential frontrunner Herman Cain. Mark Feldstein, a professor of media and public affairs at George Washington University and author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture, joins us to provide an historical context to the broken political system that Herman Cain claims is victimizing him along with the Democratic Party machine. Then we will discuss another magnet for scandal, Silvio Berlusconi, the embattled Italian prime minister who is currently a defendant in three trials for bribery, tax fraud, abuse of power, and paying for sex with a 17-year-old girl. Domenico Lombard, an expert on international monetary relations, joins us to discuss the Italian debt crisis. And since Berlusconi is reported to be ready to step down after the next budget is approved by Parliament, how his exit will affect the future of the Eurozone's third largest economy. Then finally, Jamie Henn joins us. He is the co-founder of the environmental group 350.org, which has been leading protests at the White House that culminated with a huge demonstration Sunday against the proposed Keystone Pipeline from the tar sands of Alberta, Canada, to refineries in Texas. We will discuss the political future of the pipeline that has President Obama and the State Department in the hot seat. Joining us now is Mark Feldstein, a professor of media and public affairs at George Washington University and author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture, which will be out soon in paperback. For over two decades, he has been an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, NBC, and a two-time winner of the George Foster Peabody Award. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Feldstein.
Great to be here again, Ian.
And the press conference that Herman Cain had today was for anybody that endured it. It was both a low moment for an embattled politician, but it was also a low moment for the press, in spite of the manifest nature of this growing scandal and the hollow denials from the candidate. The press basically didn't lay a glove on him. I was astounded.
Well, you know, he is doing what Richard Nixon and other politicians before him have done, which is to attack the media, blame the messenger for the message. I don't think it's really going to work for him, but my guess is that may have had a temporary effect on cowing their performance in the immediate aftermath. But you know, this isn't going away. The first of four women has gone public. We're going to be hearing more. You know, more shoes are going to drop coming down the pike. And it's hard to see how he's going to be able to really survive this as a viable candidate.
Well, in speaking of shoes that are about to drop, already the New York Times has met with Karen Krashauer, who is one of the two women who settled sexual harassment claims against Herman Cain with the National Restaurant Association. Now, she is currently a spokesperson at the Treasury Department, and since her name was leaked in the press, she's now decided to talk to the New York Times. But what is particularly alarming, if what she's told the New York Times, and I mean alarming for Herman Cain, is that she said, this woman said, that she has been warming to the idea of a joint press conference where all of the women would be together with our attorneys and all of this evidence would be considered together. These allegations can be considered together as a body of evidence. Don't you think, Mark Feldstein, wouldn't that be the death blow to
Well, you know, whether it's probably, yeah, it would probably in one fell swoop. But, you know, it could also be a death by, if not a thousand cuts, at least multiple cuts. If, you know, the women are going to end up coming forward, you know, because, you know, the first ones happened and now he denies all of them and they're going to feel some solidarity with each other. And so, you know, these things don't usually happen in a vacuum. With Clarence Thomas, it was sort of the same thing. Not just an isolated case, but part of a pattern. The difference is there. The Senate Judiciary Committee, with Joe Biden as chairman, was cowed from calling the other women. and that effectively shut them off at the source. That doesn't seem to be the case here. And this guy's running for president. He was always an unlikely long shot anyway. But my guess is that, you know, in a few months' time, Herman Cain's name will just be the punchline of a joke. And, you know, 10 years from now, it'll be "where is he now" kinds of stories, if any, are done about him.
Well, Mark Feldstein, he, in answering the question, or not that he answered any of the questions really, but in answering the question about who do you think's behind this, he said that it's the Democratic Party machine. And again, nobody in the press pointed out the obvious absurdity of that, which is that the Democrats would love this guy to be the presidential nominee of the Republicans.
Well, that's right. And if the Democrats were going to time it for maximum political effect, they would wait a year or, you know, 11 months until he's the nominee and blow him up on the eve of the election. But, you know, if you don't have a defense, you go on the offense. And so attacking the press, attacking the Democrats, attacking the women is what he's been doing. I don't think it's going to stand up.
Well, your book, the Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture, which will be out soon in paperback.
Actually out in the stores now.
Oh, it's out in the stores now. Oh, well, well, there you go. I'm glad you corrected me. The obviously, there's a history here that you've documented, and we've spoken about current scandals in the past. But I must say, this is getting kind of exhausting, though. You know, when you've got the you've got
think
this
how Herman Cain must feel.
Well, I know, but if you've got this sort of ambulance chasing woman, Gloria Allred, representing this woman, and it's just whether it's a political scandal or a Hollywood scandal, they keep coming thicker and faster, and they all have. And we just had the conviction of the Michael Jackson's doctor,
right.
and that was dominating the headlines. There seems to be an endless appetite for this maudlin stuff. Or do you think it's just that the media has found a way to get cheap programming?
Well, I think it's both. You know, there's actually a tradition in this country of what I call the sexpose, the journalistic expose about sex that does go back to the founding of the Republic. And Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, the founders of our two major political parties, were battling each other and using their own partisan newspapers to expose the sex lives of the other. We know about Sally Hemings, the slave mistress of Jefferson, because of a leak to a Hamilton newspaper. So there is a long tradition of this, and it is a weapon of partisan warfare. But you have that now merged with a for-profit media that, you know, whose ratings go up or whose circulation goes up, the more the substance goes down. And with these kind of tabloid stories, you know, people buy it and they tune in. And, you know, I sometimes think the TV networks would run live executions with nude anchors if the ratings went up. You know, that's been the general trend for almost the past generation now, the tarting up of the news.
Well, Mark Feldstein, the fact that we started out with a kind of our original politics under the Founding Fathers was a real contact sport, and they slimed each other and published sexual innuendo or even more blatant stuff, where political candidates in those days had rival newspapers. So flashing forward to the present, just before this happened, at the time that you document in your book, seems to have been the turning point under Nixon, because we all know that Jack Kennedy had a healthy appetite for women, and he even had two women on the National Security Council, Fiddle and Faddle, who swam with him in the White House pool on a regular basis. And all the press knew about this, but nobody said anything. So what explains that gap where there was a kind of an understanding that this stuff was off the record?
Well, that's a great question, and you're right. The press as a whole did know about Kennedy's womanizing, and kept it quiet, because the standard belief then was that if it didn't, if you know, sexual liaisons didn't affect public behavior, it deserved to be private. That really did start to change with Watergate, where there was much more of, you know, bringing down of a crooked president whose personal flaws seemed to be at the root of his corruption, and with you know, every journalist afterwards wanting to be another Woodward and Bernstein and have another you know, blockbuster movie starring Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman made. And so you've had that, and then in the last generation you've also had the economics change, where news organizations are more and more consolidated, owned by profit-making conglomerates whose interests aren't necessarily journalism in its most button-down fashion, but are really about making money. You know, certainly we had the yellow press before and the tabloid journalism of Hearst and Pulitzer, but it's now sort of spread to every medium, you know, from talk radio to television, tabloid television, the cable news networks have 24 hours to fill and not enough news, so they tart it up that way. And the internet, which, you know, spreads everything instantaneously. So all these things kind of have reinforced, but I really trace it back to sort of the post-Nixon era.
So how do you explain this current scandal, Mark Feldstein, again, professor of media and public affairs at George Washington University and the author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture? Mark's been an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, and NBC, and is two-time winner of the George Foster Peabody Award. So you have this candidate who's said, I'm a different candidate, I'm a business CEO, I'm going to run the country like a business. And a lot of the Tea Party Republicans find that very appealing. They also find it very appealing that he's not a Beltway politician. But now he's behaving like a Beltway politician. I mean, he's handled this, these blanket denials just are totally inadequate. They've boxed him in. And as the evidence mounts, the denials get more and more absurd. But then you could argue that this has been an absurdity from day one. I mean, that is another way to look at it.
Yeah, and I think it is. I mean, you know, all of these, I remember in the 80s when the candidates on the Democratic side were less than towering. They were referred to as the Seven Dwarves. Well, you know, they look like giants positively, Dukakis and the rest of them, compared to the midgets running on the Republican side, my God, you know, or more like a freak show, or the bar scene at Star Wars, you know, Michelle Bachmann. You couldn't make some of these people up. So I think Herman Cain was a fluke to begin with, an unlikely candidate, and he came out of nowhere, and you know, he hadn't been vetted. You know, because he hadn't run for office before. Because he didn't really have a public persona, you know, this kind of stuff that would normally come out in the course of a campaign for lesser office was buried. And so, I mean, this is what happens when you kind of go with a wild card, and it can turn up to be an ace, or it can turn up to be a three or a two.
Right. But the important thing is, Mark, he is ahead in he's the front runner for the Republican primaries to become president of the United States.
Yeah, but it ain't going to happen. You know, give it a few days, give it a week. That those poll numbers are going to drop. The candidates will winnow out, and he is not going to come anywhere close to being a Republican nominee, let alone president. I don't know. I could be wrong. I mean,
I don't dispute
would become president, and he did. So anything's possible. But that would be like us electing Berlusconi or Donald Trump or something. I mean, we're past the point of satire at this point. We're really approaching pathos, and it's not going to come to that.
Well, let me read something apropos from the wires here. Berlusconi steps down, will run National Restaurant Association. A dream job for me, says Italian PM. Showing the resiliency that has frustrated foes throughout his storied career, Silvio Berlusconi today stepped down as Italian Prime Minister and assumed the helm of the National Restaurant Association. This is a dream job for me, Mr. Berlusconi told reporters as he settled into his new office in Washington. I love working with people and I tend to be very hands-on. Mr. Berlusconi won the coveted position after beating out several rivals, including former International Monetary Fund chief Dominique Strauss-Kahn. I must admit I'm very envious of Silvio, Mr. Strauss-Kahn said. There isn't a red-blooded man alive who wouldn't want to run the National Restaurant Association. But even as he settled into his new post, Mr. Berlusconi served notice that there were going to be big changes ahead for the trade association. I've taken a look at the employees and they're way too old. Now, of course, that is satire from Andy Borowitz of the Borowitz Report. But
that's pretty good.
I couldn't resist that since you gave me an opening there. But, Mark, seriously, where the press has, I think, failed with Kane, and now that scandal has consumed it, it's they're off on a tear about scandal. But what very few reporters, and the New York Times recently picked it up, but mostly it came from a newspaper in Wisconsin. I wish I remember the name of it, but the whole point of this campaign, as far as I can tell, is that it's a two-man show. That is Kane and this fellow Mark Block, who's featured in the bizarre campaign commercial, smoking a cigarette and blowing smoke at the camera. He apparently is literally the Koch brothers' man. He was banned from Wisconsin politics for 3 years for improprieties, fairly serious ones. And then a couple of days after he was unbanned, the Kochs hired him. And he succeeded in getting two Tea Party congressmen elected, the governor elected, and the Republican senator, who knocked off the famous campaign finance senator. Russ Feingold. So huge trifecta for the Koch brothers. And so that's the real question. We shouldn't be talking about this scandal. The questions that we should be asking is, what are the Koch brothers getting out of this?
Well, I think that's right, and points to a larger issue, which is that, you know, in a certain sense, of all of the things that make Herman Cain unqualified to be president, in some ways this is the least of them. But it's the sexiest, and that's why what the media is feasting upon. But his policy ideas, his ties to the Koch brothers, as you point out, these are actually not to minimize at all the sexual harassment, but those alone should have knocked him out of the starting gate. But you have some very odd candidates running now for on the Republican side who, deny scientific fact and, whether it's evolution or global warming. So I guess this is just a part of it.
So then, just in closing then, Mark Feldstein, I don't understand, though, why, he's obviously his behavior is sufficiently egregious that there's this press drip torture is going to go on until he finally either gets out. I mean, he must be in some serious denial because he was quite passionate about his innocence, but it doesn't gel with the facts. And his excuses were kind of pathetic. But the fact of the matter is that he should have been disqualified long ago, and I wonder why he wasn't. His outrageous racist remarks about Muslims, how he wouldn't have a Muslim in his administration, the impression that I get is that he's been actually getting away with more than anybody else would, and I'm wondering whether it's to do with the fact that he's an African American and that he's as Ann Coulter said in the most outrageous and patronizing way, our blacks are better than their blacks. Talk about a plantation mentality there.
Yeah, it was pretty outrageous, and you can only imagine what if there had ever been a hint of a whisper of any kind of sexual issues with Barack Obama, how different the Republican reaction would be to that, and how utterly devastating that would have been to his campaign. But I also think that, you know, you have these kind of outlier Republican candidates, and you know they don't and except really for Romney or maybe Huntsman and Perry, you know, none of them really passed the plausibility test as nominees. They all have, you know, either skeletons in their closet or really kind of, you know, fringe views. It may be that the Tea Party and the fringe element in the Republican Party has some disproportionate weight in some of these early polls and caucuses. But, I think it's also a way the media occupies airtime and print space at this point. You know, and you build one up and then you tear it down, like that song Dirty Laundry. There was Bachman, who was built up for a while based on a straw poll of rather meaningless value.
Right, and Ron Paul was only two or three votes behind her, and they ignored him.
Right. I think it's, you know, a little bit of taking turns on who's going to be flavor du jour for a week or two before, you know, the long campaign settles in.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Mark Feldstein.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Feldstein. He's a professor of media and public affairs at George Washington University. He's the author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture, which is now out in paperback. He's an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, NBC, and a two-time winner of the George Foster Peabody Award. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about that other magnet for scandal, Silvio Berlusconi. Welcome back. I'm Ian Master. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Domenico Lombard, who's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution specializing in global economy and development. He is an expert on the G20 and G8 summits, international monetary relations, and global currencies. His current projects focus on the recent international financial crisis, the ongoing European crisis, and the reform of the IMF and the World Bank. Welcome to Background Briefing, Domenico Lombard.
Thank you.
And of course, this has been a very dramatic day in Italy, Domenico, with the Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi telling apparently the President of Italy, Giorgio Napolitano, that he plans to step down after the next budget is approved by Parliament. So that's a bit of a switch from the kind of defiant Berlusconi who has survived over 50 no confidence motions. Is he sort of is this his signal that I'm going to sacrifice my political career for the good of the country, or do you think he's going to make another comeback?
Well, the signal that we have seen today is that his days as the Prime Minister of Italy may be numbered, but not necessarily in terms of the politician who's still able to shape the Italian political faith. And in fact, what the results have shown today is that he doesn't have a big enough majority in the lower chamber of the parliament, running 8 MPs short, but he still commands a majority in the Senate. And therefore, as a result, he's still able to have a veto power over any further political development. He may not be able to have enough of a political strength to back his own government, but of course he would have a considerable say, if not an outright veto power, in determining the future political choice in the country.
But the budget vote, which was passed with 380 votes, more than half of the country's 630 lawmakers abstained or didn't even show up for the vote. Obviously, they didn't want to prevent the budget from being approved, but they also didn't want to lend Berlusconi any support. So that seems to be the mixed signal here.
The opposition decided to abstain. They could have voted against. They decided to abstain because they realized that if they had voted against, this would have triggered the freezing of all the government spending with unpredictable consequences, especially in light of the current circumstances Italy is going through. But the political outcome remains that Berlusconi is not able to leverage on a majority in the lower house, and therefore the option that the center-right coalition is exploring at the moment is to present an alternative candidate drawn from the same coalition, whom they hope will be able to attract some marginal votes from earlier defectors in the lower house, so that the center-right coalition will still be in charge and will be able to express a new government replacing the current Berlusconi's government.
So, Domenico Lombard, what is going to happen then in terms of, because Italy's the yield on Italian bonds hit a record high on Monday, very close to the 7% mark, which is considered unsustainable. So what's going to be done here to turn things around? You're saying that Berlusconi has not exited the scene. So what's going to be done in terms of Italy's debt, which is about 120% of its economic output? I believe it's about, 2.6 trillion dollars we're talking about?
The current stock of the Italian public debt is 1.9 trillion of euros, mm-hmm. which approximately are equivalent to $2.6 trillion. It's also equivalent to 120% of the Italian GDP, and is therefore one of the highest debt in the world, something that could really trigger a systemic collapse of the global financial system if the Italian crisis were left to escalate without any proper corrective action. And this is why the President of the Republic, of course, will have a key role, because based on his own constitutional mandate, once he formally receives the resignation from Mr. Berlusconi, he will be then in a position to open consultations among all the party political leaders and appoint someone who must command a possible majority in both houses of the parliament. Clearly, the financial markets have already expressed their no confidence vote with respect to Mr. Berlusconi's government. His government has had a long window of opportunity to engineer a number of reforms to stabilize market pressure, and yet a constant delay of action have dragged the country to the point where it is right now. Some political observers, as well as many citizens, hope that this defeat will pave the way to a more reformist-minded government, which might ideally be led by an eminent personality who would command the highest respect in Italy, in Europe, and in the world, and could possibly be outside the political circles. But the fact remains that the center-right coalition still have an overwhelming political force despite today's results, and of course they are going to use all the levers they have to affect the future political developments of the country.
Again, I'm speaking with Dominika Lombard, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, whose projects focus on recent international financial crises, the ongoing European crisis, and reform of the IMF and the World Bank. So what's the ticking clock with Italy? Isn't there a $300 billion payment that's due pretty soon?
Right now, the Italian Treasury has to borrow from the markets 37 billion euros till December 31st. And next year, throughout the whole 2012, the Treasury will have to roll over portions of the public debt equivalent to 287 billion euros approximately. These are big amounts, and this also highlights that traditional conventional instruments of intervention such as an IMF or a European Rescue Fund program would not be enough to stabilize Italy should the crisis escalate, simply because these institutions do not have enough financial firepower. And this is why the emphasis is on the preventive side, on escalating the pressure on the authorities to make sure that they act needed corrective policy measures on the one hand, and on the other hand, they have persuaded the authorities to ask for monitoring from the International Monetary Fund, who's going to come to Rome in the next few days to agree on a program of implementation of reforms, which the IMF is going to monitor on a quarterly basis so as to provide a sort of independent third-party monitoring to the progress that the authorities will be making. Clearly, this escalation of the crisis in Italy creates a great deal of suspense in Europe. President Sarkozy is well aware that the destiny of his own country is tightly linked to that of Italy, the neighbor, simply because many French banks have too many Italian government bonds in their portfolios, as well as having direct stakes in some Italian banks. And therefore, any fallout or even a deterioration in the Italian financial sector would have a direct spillover effect to France, and through France, of course, Germany would also be affected. And this is exactly why European leaders and the U.S. administration are doing everything they can to make pressure, to pressure the Europeans, in particular the Italians, and the President of the Republic right now, to make everything they can so that corrective policy measures are enacted at the earliest.
So, Dominika Lombard, it seems a little bit like we've seen this movie before in Greece and Ireland and in England too, with the austerity. And I'm trying to understand how it is that when you have a situation where the debts become unserviceable, where do you get the revenues? They keep borrowing money in order to cover the debt payments, but the only way you really get out of this hole is to generate revenues. The same thing applies to the United States government. We need to stimulate our economy, not go for austerity. Yet that's happening in England, and the results are manifestly clear. It's happening here. It's created a slowdown in our economy. Where is the are the revenues going to come? What's going to kickstart the Italian economy to start producing revenues to pay down these debts?
First of all, Italy, despite all its problems, is still very far away from the prospect of default. So this is clearly a deterioration of the market conditions that we are witnessing right now, maybe even drastic deterioration. but we are still very far away from the prospect, even the prospect of a default. That said, the true underlying weakness of the Italian economy is not so much the fiscal balances, but a very low rate of growth that its economy has exhibited over the latest decade. And therefore, if you really want to tackle this situation, the instability that is emerging, you know, that has been emerging over the latest few weeks and months, clearly the achievement of a balanced budget is important, but is not the fundamental element in this strategy, which is really to boost growth, to make sure that the economy grows at higher rate, at a much higher rate, so as to support the burden of a very high public debt. And this is really the key objective, but also the objective that the current Italian authorities have been missing for months. They've been focusing on the achievement of balanced budget without having, you know, the broader picture. In the United States, the situation, I would say, is fundamentally different because, first, the economy has a very high rate of potential growth. Yes, the current economic recovery is weak, still needs to be nurtured, to be sustained, but overall, the economy has competitive enough, has you know, is strong enough to exhibit, in the long run, a much higher rate of growth. Which would be able, of course, in turn to sustain a higher pile of debt. That said, the current strategy that policymakers and lawmakers in Washington are trying to enact, although, you know, with different accents depending on the political party, is one of supporting demand in the short term to give a boost to the recovery in a framework of medium-term consolidation. And of course, this is a very appropriate strategy, but one that also carries some risks because on the one hand, you want to be supportive of aggregate demand, but at the same time, you cannot be too harsh in terms of, you know, cutting expenditures because if I know that 1 year or 2 years down the road, the government is going to cut my entitlements, of course, I will have, you know, an incentive to save rather than buy more goods and services. So I think this is really where, you know, the tricky part lies in finding the appropriate balance between a boost to the in the short term to the economy, and at the same time, if a broader framework of medium long term consolidation.
Well, Dominika Lombard, there's certainly an analogy here with the United States, is that it's the lack of demand that has the economy stalled. Corporations are sitting on a lot of money, but customers and consumers just aren't buying. So what is this budget that has just passed without the you know, with an awful lot of the lawmakers abstaining in order to get it to pass, but indicating, of course, that Berlusconi doesn't have a majority. What's in the budget? Because when analysts make these comparisons with Greece and Italy, obviously, which are very tenuous. The impression that one gets is that these economies that are in trouble, people don't pay their taxes, they have too many benefits and too many rich retirement packages, etc., and that those things have to be cut. So give us a sense of what this budget does in terms of what you just said, which is you don't really austerity is not going to help if people are going to retrench and save when you want them to spend.
The situation in the U.S. is again fundamentally different from that of Europe, insofar as it is certainly true that in Europe, national governments made their own mistakes, in some cases even fudged their national statistics, as has been the case of Greece, for instance. But it is also true that these countries have been exposed to a unique scope for contagion and spillovers given by the unprecedented monetary, financial, and economic integration among euro area countries, which at the same time, you know, have exposed themselves to the unprecedented, as I said, spillovers from the policies of other countries in the monetary union. So, and at the same time, on top of that, you've got that these countries, that there is not enough of an institutional framework that would compensate for this exposure to the spillovers from other countries. So, just to make an example, in the case of Europe, the national governments do issue government debt, and yet it is a little bit as if, you know, this debt were issued in a foreign currency, because the central bank cannot really intervene in support of this debt that is being issued. In the United States, the situation is completely different, because the U.S., of course, issues its own currency, and therefore the Fed, the United States Central Bank, can play a unique stabilizing role. So, where the country will stand, what kind of political future the country will be able to draw for himself. But I would really close by saying that the resignation by Prime Minister Berlusconi would not trigger necessarily a long-awaited political change.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Domenico Lombard.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Domenico Lombard, who's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, specializing in global economy and development. He is an expert on G20 and G8 summits, international monetary relations, and global currencies. His current projects focus on the recent international financial crisis, the ongoing European crisis, and reforms of the IMF and the World Bank. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about demonstrations in Washington against the Keystone Pipeline. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jamie Henn, who's the co-founder with Bill McKibben of 350.org. In 2009, he coordinated media for over 5,200 simultaneous events in more than 180 countries, landing 350.org on front pages and newscasts around the world. CNN called the event the most widespread day of political action in history. Previously, he helped lead the Set It Up 2007 campaign. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jamie Henn.
Thank you very much.
And you were in Washington, D.C. on Sunday at an extraordinary demonstration that had people holding hands around the White House. I think what it circled the White House three or four times, the number of people.
That's right.
And,
I just returned from Washington, D.C., and it was an incredible scene down at the White House on Sunday. We had hoped to have just enough people to surround the White House once, which hadn't been done for quite a while. It turned out that we had enough to go around it three, sometimes four deep. There were over 12,000 people there, people bussing in from all across the country and Canada. And it was a real sign that this fight against the Keystone XL pipeline is gaining momentum by the day. And hopefully the president is getting the right message that if he's willing to stand up to big oil and deny the permit for this pipeline, he'll have all the support he needs to do it.
And the television pictures I saw featured this great big kind of tube-like pipeline that was carried, and it was carried to, is it the headquarters of the American Petroleum Institute?
Well, I believe the pipeline made its rounds across Washington, D.C., so it may have made it over to API. But there's going to be demonstrations all across the country around this issue. This is the second time that there's been big protests in Washington, D.C. This fight really started at a national level last August, when over 1,253 people were arrested at the White House over a two-week sit-in. Since then, there have been protests at nearly every public appearance President Obama has made, as well as large groups of people visiting Obama for America offices around the country and saying, listen, this is a top priority for us, and we think it should be a top priority for the president, and we're not willing to volunteer or donate to the campaign until the president shows that he's willing to stand up for his values and really deny the permit for this pipeline.
And, of course, I spoke with your partner, co-founder of 350.org, Bill McKibben, when he was just released from jail, and that was some time back. So the heat's been on for a while, and clearly I think the White House and the State Department have been feeling the heat. The State Department's Inspector General now will conduct a special investigation into the handling of the permitting process that took place, which itself was very questionable. The pipeline developer TransCanada hired a company, Cardno Entrix, that they encouraged the State Department to hire the company Cardno Entrix, that was supposed to do the independent investigation of the pipeline. And, of course, the chief lobbyist for TransCanada is Paul Elliott, who was a senior staff member to Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton's 2008 presidential campaign. Now, it would seem that the attention that your organization and others have brought to this issue have caused the Obama administration to instigate a special investigation by the Inspector General of the State Department.
Well, it's been amazing to watch the politics of this issue change since we started working on it, and have continued to work on it with people from all across the country and a lot of different organizations seizing on this fight. When we started, it looked like this pipeline was going to go through without a doubt. The odds were 1,000 to 1 in stopping it. TransCanada, as you mentioned, had done everything it should do to wire the process, from hiring lobbyists to making the right donations to getting the Canadian government involved in lobbying on behalf of the pipeline. Since we've shined this spotlight on this issue, the politics have begun to shift. There was just a report in the Washington Post last week completely debunking the jobs claims that TransCanada had been making. And the more that we dig into the State Department process, the more we see that the type of cronyism and corruption that a lot of people in the Occupy movement and around the country have been really trying to draw attention to as well. So I think that as we move forward, the more that we can keep this in the spotlight, the more that we can continue to dig into the process, and the more that people continue to stand up for what's right, the more that we'll have a chance in stopping this thing. It would be a huge accomplishment, a real sign that there's a movement around this country that can help take on big fossil fuel projects like this, and I think a show of strength for a climate movement and an environmental movement that really does need to begin to articulate the need to move beyond these extreme forms of energy and point to the real job potential in this country for clean energy and the types of investments that we hope President Obama will be making.
Again, I'm speaking with Jamie Henn, the co-founder with Bill McKibben of 350.org, and we're talking about the demonstrations on Sunday in Washington, D.C., where thousands of people showed up and surrounded the White House several times holding hands to protest this proposed Keystone Pipeline from the tar sands of Alberta across the United States to refineries in Texas. Originally, the State Department was supposed to sign off on the approval at the end of this year. Then the president would make the decision. It looks like the president's going to punt on this because this is a difficult issue for him in an election year. And he doesn't want to alienate his base. So it sounds like with the Inspector General report that could take several months and objections from states along the proposed route of the pipeline, particularly Nebraska, that could delay the decision for months. So do you expect this decision to happen before or after the 2012 election?
Well, it's hard to tell, and I'm not really a professional Beltway tea leaf reader, so I'll leave.
Well,
that
I listen. I appreciate
either
that.
Either way, we're going to keep pushing because this is an important way not only to stop the pipeline, but to really put climate and energy issues back on the agenda and help this president live up to the promises he made when he first ran in 2008. I mean, this was the guy that said, let's be the generation that ends the tyranny of oil, that in his presidency, the oceans would begin to subside and the planet would begin to heal. Now, that was high rhetoric, but we still think that he needs to live up to those promises. And there's actually a lot that people in California can be doing to help with that. First and foremost is continuing to put pressure on the president about this Keystone XL pipeline. Later on this month, we're going to be having people in all 50 states visiting Obama for America offices and making it known that this is a key priority in the election, and we're going to need help with that in California. The second piece is that Senator Boxer plays a really important role in this. She helped really launch this Inspector General investigation into the State Department with a letter that she signed on to along with some of her colleagues in the Senate. What we'd like to see the senator do as well is really have a hearing in the Senate that books into the jobs claims that TransCanada continues to make, which are completely bogus and based on reports that have been only funded by the oil industry. So California could play a key role here in not only pressuring the president, but also beginning to debunk the type of rhetoric that we've seen coming from the fossil fuel industry. And we're really excited to see what the role this state can play and what the role everyday people can play in really helping reveal what's going on with this process and helping stop this pipeline.
So, Jamie Henn, describe a little bit, if you can, what happened on Sunday. I understand actor Mark Ruffalo was there demonstrating along with the Presidential Medal of Freedom winner John Adams.
That's right. It was an incredible crowd that really did come from almost all 50 states. We had huge busloads of people coming from colleges in Ohio and from the Gulf Coast and from Texas and Nebraska, where this pipeline would run through, and some really notable figures as well. John Adams, who you mentioned, is the founder of the National Resources Defense Council and a Medal of Freedom winner. This is a guy that's, you know, been doing environmental policy and doing it in a very mainstream way for his entire life. He told USA Today that he felt like he was not only proud to be there on Sunday, but wished that he had gotten arrested with the 1,250 other people that did in August. It's just a small sign that this issue really has galvanized more of a fighting environmental movement that we've needed in this country for a long time. And I think it's a sign to the president of the type of energy and commitment people are bringing to this issue. This is exactly what he needs if he wants to win in 2012, this type of passion, this type of energy, the type of explosive organizing that's been happening around the country on this issue is what I think his campaign is hoping to tap into. And so the message we keep trying to bring is that this is not only an opportunity to say no to a devastating project, but really resurrect the type of momentum that this movement has needed to implement the clean energy changes that we hope to see.
And, of course, some of the people that have been arrested, along with Bill McKibben, the co-founder of your organization, 350.org, actress Daryl Hannah was arrested back in August. Jim Hansen, right, the chief scientist for NASA, he's apparently said that if this pipeline goes through and this heavy, thick crude from extracted from the tar sands of Alberta reaches the refineries in Texas, it's game over for the environment.
That's right. Well, in a sane political world, when your top NASA climate scientist says that fully exploiting the tar sands and unconventional fuel like that would spell essentially game over for the planet, you'd think that you wouldn't go through with the project. But here in the United States, of course, there's a lot of other players in that game, including the fossil fuel industry that clearly has more money to spend on this than anyone has ever had in history. So we saw Dr. Hansen come out and realize, you know, that he had to do more and was arrested there at the White House. There was also 20 other scientists who wrote to President Obama, 20 of our top climate scientists in the U.S., I should say, encouraging him to deny the project. Again, you know, this has really brought together such a unique coalition of folks, from actors, as you mentioned, to our top scientists, to people in Nebraska and Texas who are Tea Party supporters, not your typical environmentalists. So we've really seen kind of red states and blue states come out and say, look, this is not the right direction for America. We know that the future of our economy is not with dirty oil. And we know that the real jobs potential in terms of fixing up our economy is turning away from this sort of stuff and turning towards the incredible potential of solar and wind and clean electricity to really push the type of economic recovery that we need.
So, Jamie Henn, clearly you've organized not just the SolarCity.org, but the simultaneous events of 5,200 of them in 180 countries, and then previously you set up the 2000 campaign. Tell me about the organization that has brought all of these people around the world acting in concert with the demonstration that took place on Sunday in Washington, D.C. For example, Egyptian activists visited the Canadian embassy to make it clear that committing to the tar sands would threaten, to dry out the kind of the precious Nile, which of course is a victim of global warming. It's worth noting, by the way, that one of the things about this tar sands process from Canada, which is not, I don't think, being sufficiently analyzed, is that at the end of the day, the price of getting the oil out may be the destruction of so much water that we'll end up waking up and realizing that we've lost an even more precious commodity, which is water, because the water that is required under these high-pressure steam hoses to separate the sand from the tar from the sand is then stored in these vast ponds, this brackish polluted water, which is useless forever. And that's one of the great ironies, that none of the costs of water costs and environmental costs have been factored into the business decision to extract this oil.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think that the message we need to keep bringing forward and keep shining a light on is that this really isn't everyday oil. I mean, this really is an extreme form of energy. The reason it's been sitting up there for a long time is because it was so environmentally destructive and so expensive to produce that we Canadians had sensibly left it in the ground. Now, as the price of oil continues to rise and we begin to run out of oil around the world, they're turning to these more extreme forms of energy instead of turning to the types of clean energy which are abundant and we could be investing in. The same speaks true for processes like hydrofracking and the distances that we're going to go to for deep water drilling, as we saw in the Gulf. You mentioned the international aspect of this, and it really is one of the most exciting pieces of working on climate change and working on global warming now. For the first time, we're really beginning to pull together a global movement to take on this essentially global problem.
I'm afraid we've run out of time here, but thank you so much for joining us and for the work that you do, Jamie Henn.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Jamie Henn, the co-founder with Bill McKibben of 350.org. In 2009, he coordinated media for over 5,200 simultaneous events in more than 180 countries, landing 350.org on the front pages of newscasts around the world, and previously helped lead the Set It Up 2007 campaign. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.